Tim Brooks is up next. I think everybody in this room knows Tim Brooks. He's widely recognized as one of television's leading historians. He's also a leader in the field of sound recording research. He served as the president of ARSC, and his contributions to the organization and to the field are legion and ongoing. His presentation today is drawn from a chapter in his book, Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry. That was a groundbreaking treatise that won multiple major academic awards. His double CD reissue by the same name on Archaeophone Records won a Grammy in 2007. Please welcome our colleague and friend, Tim Brooks.
People next door, too. That's nice. I thought that somewhere on this presentation, on this conference, it might be a good idea to take a look at the very, 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 very earliest recordings made in this city that's so famous for recordings over so many years. We heard about some of them this morning. And in fact, recording goes back in New Orleans to the 1890s, to the very beginning of commercial recording. And I'm talking about commercial recording, multiple copies, distributed copies, as opposed to private recordings, such as the one we just heard about. So it turns out there was, in fact, a record company in New Orleans quite early, and there was interesting music in New Orleans, apparently, quite early, although, as you've just heard, it's hard to reconstruct. Have the first slide, please. This is a drawing from a newspaper in 1890, in New Orleans. Many people have tried to figure out this. There's a four-piece black band up on the rooftop there outside the Dime Museum. They're obviously playing rather loudly. The man is shouting, "For God's sake, stop." The woman is holding her ears. People are falling down in the streets. Others are turning into animals on the sidewalk. It's a four-piece band of African Americans. The instrumentation is rather curiously like later jazz bands, trombone, trumpet, clarinet, and drums. But you know, obviously, we can't hear what they're doing. That's the whole point. What is it that they were playing? If only somebody had had an Edison machine on the street there, grinding away, so we could know what was happening even before Buddy Bolden. Next slide, please. Well, the phonograph did come to New Orleans. In the early 1880s, there were demonstrations of the tinfoil phonograph, as there were in many places around the country. And as most of you know, the phonograph went into hibernation for a while when it was worked on by various people until a perfected version came out in the late 1880s. Four brothers got the franchise, two sets of brothers actually, got the franchise for the Texas Phonograph Company in 1889. Headquartered in Galveston, H. Lee and Robert Sellers and Hugh and Thomas Coynington, at least that's how I'll pronounce it, they set up the company and operated it as Edison wanted and as the prevailing thinking was, as a business machine company. Unfortunately, not a lot of business was going on in Galveston, apparently, or in the wide open spaces of Texas at that time, and the company really had a difficult time operating. It was very far removed from the Northeast, the home base where machines came from and were repaired and so forth as well. Nevertheless, the two sets of brothers in 1891 obtained the last available franchise for a regional distributorship of the North American Phonograph Company, that for Louisiana, and set up shop right here in New Orleans, a few blocks from here actually. They set up offices in the Equitable Building, which was on Gravier Street in the business district, and had a warehouse and music rooms on Barone Street, just a few blocks from there, all within walking distance of here. They had a demonstration to debut their company to the public and to the press in January of 1891, well covered in the Times-Picayune and in the Daily States, the two major newspapers of that time. And they included in their demonstrations of the Edison phonograph that they were bringing for commercial purposes to New Orleans and to Louisiana a wide range of musical cylinders. These seem to have been cylinders that were imported from the North, where the North American company or other affiliates, New Jersey, Columbia, and so forth, were turning out cylinders at that early stage, as opposed to cylinders made locally. This is in January of 1891. But they did make clear that they were going to have local talent, too, make records of their own. Of course, many of the local companies did that. So the next couple of months, this is early 1891, were spent getting that going and setting up machines around the city, which they would then feed both with imported cylinders and with cylinders that they made locally. I should mention that there have been reports of cylinders that were made for them by companies in the Northeast. So J.W. Myers' recording for the Louisiana Phonograph Company, as far as we know, J.W. Myers never came to New Orleans, but he certainly, they would make custom recordings for them. New Jersey, other companies would do that. But they were clear that they would make some locally, too. One other big difference about the Louisiana Phonograph Company, based on their searing experience in Texas, they emphasized entertainment from the start. Can I have the next slide, please? They made no bones about it. They were going to have an active program of recording. They were going to be a musical company. They actively proselytized for music, as a matter of fact. Unlike many of the other companies, which still stuck to the business use. And one of the Coinington brothers, as a matter of fact, wrote a piece for the Phonogram, the national publication of the recording industry at that time, which was kind of a dialogue between the business phonograph and the entertainment phonograph, as they saw it in 1891. And I think we'll give you a little dramatic reading here to give you an idea of what the debate was all about in 1891, and the side one on right here. Rich is going to help me out by being the coin slot phonograph. This is Mr. Entertainment. I'm going to be the business phonograph. Brother of the silvery tongue, how has it gone with you today?
For the quality and quantity of metal that I have swallowed, my tongue should rather be nickel-coated. Scarce have I rested this whole long day, as the contents of my cash box will amply testify. How has it fared for you?
Letters, 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 with a few dry and tedious statements is the only variation. I assure you, were it not for the superiority of business use, I would be inclined to envy your task, which is at least a melodious and pleasant one.
Hold hard there, brother, hold hard. Where does that superior dignity come in? It strikes me there are two sides to that question.
Why, I intended no slur on you. I thought it was everywhere acknowledged that business use was the highest and, in fact, the only proper vocation of a perfected phonograph, while the nickel in the slot machine has been variously termed a mere music box, a panderer to amusement and the like. What can you say to the charge that it's degrading the phonograph to engage in such picayune business that its use as an attraction in bar rooms is an unmixed evil?
The phonograph is able to take such position without any degradation whatever. The picayune character of business is common to daily papers, steam ferries, streetcars, and other enterprises of undoubted utility and respectability. The drawback of being used as an attraction in saloons, it shares with fine furniture, plate glass mirrors, music instruments, and even common daily food. That fact is more a reflection on the phonograph than on the other useful articles used in the same way. And now, as we are on the temperance question and have talked ourselves dry, suppose we smile.
Coda. And then the coin machine smiled benignly through its beveled glass, but the business machine, having no glass, could only give a dry, short laugh, acknowledging that the other had the rather best of the argument. Well, that's how the Coiningtons felt about business use versus entertainment use. They made good on their promise by immediately placing coin in the slot machines, jukeboxes, around the city very aggressively. Their first location was in May's Palace Drugstore, which was an upscale location on Canal Street with a very large soda fountain and a lot of traffic going through. Next slide, please. This is Canal Street in the early 1890s, apparently. There's still horse-driven streetcars there before they electrified them. It's looking away from the river northwest at Canal and Royal, so the Mays building would have been on the right-hand side, kind of behind where we are right here. But it gives you an idea of what the street was like, the Canal Street that you'll probably walk out here looked like in the early 1890s. The coin-op machine in this drugstore, this upscale drugstore, was, by all reports, fabulously successful. According to the phonogram, in fact, it was the most successful single location in the entire United States. It started in San Francisco. There were in many cities by this time. And they reported that it had earned $1,430 in the first 3 months of operation. Well, if it's 5 cents per play, and you divide that back, that works out to approximately 300 or more than 300 plays per day continuously of this machine, like 12 or 14 hours a day. The thing is just running and running and running. You want to know why the cylinders wore out and why there are good copies left. They did change the cylinders every day. They had a staff of inspectors who roamed around the city checking the machines regularly and changing the cylinders regularly. And they had to produce a lot to do that, of course. There were coin ops around the rest of the city. Next slide, please. They also established a arcade of machines, 12 machines, out at the West End Resort, which is just north of the city on Lake Pontchartrain, where a lot of New Orleanians went to cool off during the hot summer months. And there were an additional two dozen or so machines placed individually around Louisiana more generally. They did not have traveling exhibitors. They were very careful about the maintenance of these machines. There were things to behold. They were in beveled glass cases. They were battery operated. They had little electric lights inside that glowed and made you feel your nickel was well spent. Next slide, please. They began advertising their original cylinders in the phonogram in late 1891, very early in the marketing of pre-recorded music. And by 1892, they were taking out full-page ads, national ads, of the cylinders by their two principal local artists, one of which was George Paoletti's Southern Band. You can see a long series of band selections there down the left and up on the right as well. Most of them fairly standard band items that you could get from lots of places at that time, including the Marine Band, although Dixie as rendered in the South, I would kind of like to hear that. Waltzes and polkas and so forth. And despite the many titles here and in other ads, none of these are known to survive today. Their other artist that they mention on the right there is Louis Vasseur. Next slide, please. And within a few months, their ads were featuring him exclusively. Paoletti and all his band selections apparently did not sell as well as this novelty that they had with Rudder Rasmus. And he was being featured alone. They said things like "Good for the Blues." There's the blues already in 1891 in New Orleans. And there's a line in this, note. They're very popular among both whites and blacks, which is interesting too. General feeling from the trade press was that you could not have the same machine patronized by both black and white customers because you have to put the ear tubes to your ears, and the whites are not going to put in their ears something that a black man had touched. So maybe they had separate machines for them. We don't know that. However, what was this Louis Vasseur, this Brother Rasmus character? Next slide, please. Louis B. Vasseur was born in 1858 in New Orleans. He's listed in public records as a Creole of color. He was a house painter by trade, but apparently he was a very talented comic and banjo player as well, and by the 1880s, he had formed with a man named Johnson and Vasseur's Colored Minstrels, as a sideline to his business, and they performed in various venues around New Orleans, a local minstrel troupe, minstrelsy being very big at the time, including colored minstrel troupes. He is apparently the third African-American to record commercially in the United States. Somebody has another candidate. Like to hear about that, but after George W. Johnson and a group called the Unique Quartet up in New York, 1891 would put him very close to the head of the line doing that. There's no known photo of him, but he did make recordings starting in 1891. Next slide, please. He actively recorded, as you saw from those ads, between 1891 and 1893. They were sold, certainly outside of New Orleans. In fact, copies were sent to the phonogram, copies were sent to Thomas Edison as a gift from the Louisiana franchise for him to listen to. No record of what Edison thought of this. They were also played by exhibitors up north, too. Some of them gave them compliments about being very good at attracting customers. This brought a Rasmus novelty that Bassnier had worked up. And there were special exhibitions at Mardi Gras in New Orleans in 91, 92, and 93 during that period. His repertoire seems to have been banjo solos and quartets and his brother Rasmus sermons. Next slide, please. This is the only known cylinder surviving of Bassnier. In fact, as far as I can tell, it's the only known surviving cylinder of the entire Louisiana Phonograph Company, which is amazing for the amount and the years that they recorded and all those machines grinding away all that time, and some being shipped north. We haven't found more yet, if there are more out there. As David mentioned, the humidity, the heavy use of New Orleans seems to have destroyed them all. This one, however, somehow made it through. The box is the kind of container they were using then, although not necessarily for this particular cylinder. You can see the cotton batten that they were wrapped in at that time, which traps the moisture nicely and helps take care of the cylinder if something else doesn't. They were on North American blanks with a double-edged rim at the top. Next slide. Actually, within that double rim, it's very hard to see on this, but the words Adam and Eve are actually engraved up there. These double-edged sometimes had paper labels, often they had nothing. In this case, the words of the title are there. We don't know if that was engraved at the time or if it's some later collector or something who put it there, although it is done very professionally and very carefully the way the letters are inscribed. The bad news, of course, is that the cylinder is in very, very poor condition. You can barely make it out anymore. It does seem to be a mock black sermon done in a very broad dialect with some others in the studio or in front of the horn as the congregation joining in. Brother Rasmus, the preacher, laments about the downfall of man. Did he go and hide himself in the bushes? And the congregation shouts, uh-huh. Rasmus shouts back, uh-huh, goes kind of the call and response, and then he breaks into a kind of a song or a drone that you'll hear just a little bit of. So be very patient with the sound on this. I won't torture you. I'll only play a very short segment of it. But this is what we have left, and hopefully with forensics maybe we'll get more out of it someday. But this is a little clue about black local minstrelsy in New Orleans circa 1891. Next slide, please. Well, the phonograph company had a robust run there for about 3 years, and Bassnier recorded all during that period. But by 1893, the country had plunged into a very deep economic recession, depression, really. And by 1894, the company was forced to move out of its pricey Equitable building digs into Hugh Coinington's home. In 1896, it became the Louisiana Phonograph and Kinetoscope Agency. Obviously, the kinetoscope was more current than the phonograph was by that time. And by 1897, it disappeared from sight entirely. Next slide, please. As far as Bassnier is concerned, he continued to perform in the local area. During 97, 98, he was reported as sick for a while and off the stage. In 1898, he moved to St. Louis, where he married. And we know he was still active in 1900. He took out an ad in the Indianapolis Freeman, one of the principal black newspapers, advertising his act in an original monologue turn. This is a quote, away from everybody else, no elbow or chin holding, natural facial expressions in five different dialects, no makeup. He does Negro, Dutch, Dago, Irish, and French, singing them all. This is 1900, but by 1902 he died of consumption, which was a very common disease, tuberculosis among poorer blacks of that period. The cylinder, next slide. I mentioned it's the only surviving example. We've traced it back about 20, 30 years or so. It was owned by a series of collectors in the 1970s and 80s, sold or passed from one to the next. It was reported by people who heard it then as being relatively clear and understandable. You understand the introduction and so forth. That's how we know it's Fascinator. But none of them preserved it. None of them made any attempt to tape it, much less get it to some kind of label. And eventually it was sold to a collector in England and shipped over there. And by the early 1990s, the audio had completely disintegrated, almost completely, as you heard. It was essentially a trophy passed around from collectors to collectors and without much care being taken of it. But they had it and you didn't. It's an object lesson of the destruction of irreplaceable history in the hands of people who just don't pay attention to it. And many collectors do, but many collectors don't know how to. Some archives, as we know, have problems in that area too. And it's an object lesson, the fact that cylinders of this kind, if we're going to take care of any of our history, need to be preserved, and they need to preserve now with whatever technology we have, or they'll go the way of the Vassner cylinder. And that is basically the story. Thank you. I guess we can take a couple of questions. Copies of the Vassner cylinder, there's the address you can send to, although I don't know that you'll get an answer anymore. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Tim always explains everything so well, there's no need for questions at the end.